The pre-K through 12 appropriations subcommittee will call to order. Kiva, will you please call the roll?
Chair Tomko?
Here.
Vice Chair Tuck?
Here.
Ranking Member Williams?
Here.
Representatives Alvarez?
Here, ma'am.
Gracie Davis?
Here.
Kennedy?
Here.
Daly?
Here.
Daniels?
Here.
Dunkley?
Here.
Garcia?
Here.
Gonzalez Pittman?
Present.
Lopez?
Here.
Michael? Rizzo?
Here.
Temple?
Here.
Quorum is present, Madam Chair.
A quorum being present, I want to welcome everyone to the pre-K through 12 appropriations subcommittee. Please make sure that all cell phones and other communication devices are turned off or are on silent mode. Well, good morning, members, to our second committee meeting. As I mentioned at our last meeting, the jurisdiction of our subcommittee includes the area of early learning, and that's what we are going to be concentrating on today. I am happy to welcome five panelists this morning who will be participating in our review and discussions of our state's early learning education system and services. However, before we get to our panelists, I thought it would be a good idea to provide a brief overview of the major components of our state's early learning system. This way we can provide some context that will help us better engage in the discussion with our panelists. Florida's early learning system is one of the most unique in the nation because it is largely privatized. This public-private model allows Florida to administer the state's early learning programs in a manner that prepares our state's youngest learners for future school success while directly supporting the state's workforce. The two major components of the state's early learning education system include the School Readiness Program and the Voluntary Pre-Kindergarten Program, or VPK. Specific to the School Readiness Program, prior to fiscal year 1999 through 2000, there were a number of publicly funded programs serving children between birth and the age of five. However, these programs were served different purposes, had different levels of quality, and had insufficient coordination. The Office of Program Analysis and Government Accountability completed a top-down review of these programs and their success in preparing children for kindergarten and provided the legislature with some recommendations. As a result, the legislature enacted the School Readiness Act of 1999, which officially established the state's coordinated system for school readiness. Today, this program offers financial assistance to low-income families and provides early education and care so their young children can do well in school and in the future, and families can become financially self-sufficient. Delivery of the program is comprised of child care providers and school-based sites operated by public and private schools. The Division of Early Learning and the Department of Education administers the program at the state level, and the early learning coalitions provide governance of the program at the local level. This next slide, the box on the left of the slide identifies the different types of school readiness eligibility requirements and their prioritized order. And the box on the right are the seven different types of eligible school readiness providers with the percentage of the total school readiness enrollments for fiscal year 21 through 22. As you can see, licensed private centers serve the overwhelming majority of school readiness children. On slides 5 and 6, they provide a 10-year history of school readiness funding and full-time equivalent or FTE children. For slide 5, you will see a rather significant increase in the total school readiness funding for fiscal year 22 to 23. During the 2022 legislative session, a significant piece of legislation was passed and signed into law that made substantial changes to the funding for school readiness, which included establishing additional types of school readiness allocations. These additional allocations account for the funding increase for fiscal year 2022 through 2023. For slide 6, fiscal year 20 through 21 and 21 through 22 clearly show the impact COVID has had on the state school readiness program. I anticipate our panelists will provide more detailed information on this. But moving on to the next slide and moving on to the state's VPK program, as I'm sure you all know, it was a 2002 constitutional amendment that established this program. The amendment mandated that children residing in the state who reach the age of 4 on or before September 1st of the academic year be provided a high-quality and free early childhood development and education program. Parents of eligible 4-year-olds may enroll their child in either a school year VPK program or a summer program. The next 3 slides provide a 10-year history on the funding and FTE enrollments for the VPK program. Slide 8 shows the 10-year funding history of the VPK program. You'll see that for fiscal year 22 through 23, there was a pretty significant increase in funding, and that increase can be explained by looking at this next slide. Slide 9 shows the 10-year history of the VPK Base Student Allocation, or BSA. You'll see that for fiscal year 22 through 23, the legislature increased the BSA by $317. This increase was attributable to the requirement to increase the minimum wage to $15 per hour. To help school readiness providers comply with this requirement, a calculation was done to determine the additional amount that would be needed in the BSA, and this resulted in the significant increase. Slide 10 shows the 10-year history of VPK FTE enrollments, and similar to the school readiness program, you can see the impact COVID has had by looking at the last 2 years of the program. On slide 11, as previously mentioned, at the local level, both the school readiness and VPK programs are administered by the Early Learning Coalitions. Currently, there are 30, as the map depicts, and statute requires that the composition of each ELC includes at least 15 board members, but not more than 30. Funds for both the school readiness and VPK programs are appropriated to the ELCs. And finally, I think it's important to end the presentation with an acknowledgement of the significant changes that have occurred in the early learning space in the past 2 years. Recognizing the role and importance of school readiness for our state's youngest learners, the 2021 legislature enacted legislation that changed the state's K-20 public school system to the state's early learning through 20 education system. Additionally, this legislation provides the State Board of Education with oversight and enforcement authority over the state's ELCs, created the Division of Early Learning within the Department of Education, and established a screening in progress monitoring system. The 2022 legislature continued with changes to the school readiness program by establishing a funding model framework for the school readiness program that is more similar to the funding model frameworks of the VPK program and the FEFP. However, it is my understanding that the new funding model has yet to be implemented, and I am hoping that our panelists may be able to provide more insight on this. I hope, members, this has provided you with a context for our panel discussion this morning on the state's early learning educational system and services. I'm pleased to have with us today some folks who are the experts because they are currently working in the early learning space and collectively have a substantial amount of knowledge and experience in this area. So I would like to introduce, first, we have Mr. Matt Mears, the Chancellor for the Division of Early Learning with the Department of Education. We have Jennifer Shields, the Executive Director of the Florida Association for Child Care Management. We have Roy Keister, the Vice President and Legislative Committee Co-Chair for Florida Association for Child Care Management. We have Molly Grant, the Executive Director for the Association of Early Learning Coalitions. And we have Denise Marsulo, the CEO of the Early Learning Coalition of Duval and Chair of the Association of Early Learning Coalitions. Now, I have asked each of our organization to start a panel today by providing some opening remarks that center on their organization's role in the state's early learning education system, any current fiscal issues and/or challenges, and items or issues you feel important for our subcommittee to know. So we will start with the order that's on the slide, and we'll start with the Division of Early Learning. Members, we will ask questions once they have gone through their remarks. And with that, Mr. Mears, you are recognized for your opening remarks.
Thank you so much, Chair Tomko, Vice Chair Tuck, and members. It's an honor to be here, and it's a great honor to serve as the Chancellor of the Division of Early Learning. One of the greatest opportunities in the life of a child are those early years. There's a lot of research around the first 1,000 days, around the first 5 years, and of course all that happens before a child walks through the door of their first day of kindergarten, and that's where we live, that early learning space. And so thank you for taking the time to think with us and dream with us about how we can take a wonderful system and make it even better with your backgrounds and insights. I just can't wait to see the great ideas that will come forward to to take those next steps forward in early learning. So I'm going to the areas of focus. There were three things that we looked into, and one of them, I understand, is actually going to be coming up in a presentation next week, an update on the federal funding. So I won't spend more than about just 1 minute just to kind of whet your appetite for that presentation. There's actually been $3.3 billion that Florida received for early learning for the relief funds that came as a result of the COVID pandemic. So those funds are making a huge difference, and in the session where that's unpacked, you'll see that. But there's still a piece of that is yet to be allocated, and so we just look forward to a thought partnership, the leadership from the House, the Senate, and the governor's office to determine how to best use those funds to advance early learning and to strengthen the foundations and everything right up to the, from the foundations all the way up to the top of the roof, every part of it. How can we make it better? So I'll move on from that part quickly, knowing that you're going to get a full update on the federal funding. And again, with $3.3 billion, it is a massive infusion of resources, and those are, even as we speak, being deployed. The bulk of those funds went to stabilization grants, which are funds that go to the business owners. We talked about these are private businesses. They've been impacted. And so these funds go to the private business because in Florida, we believe that those private businesses know best how to serve families. And so we give them that opportunity. We give them the resources. It's based on the number of children that they're serving and the care level. So obviously it takes a lot more. The adult-child ratio for an infant in the care is a lot higher than 4 or 5 year old. So the more infants you're serving, that would generate a larger amount. So a provider serving a lot of children gets a lot of these resources, and that's done through an application process. And right now, through the end of February, is round two. Round one gave out $500 million across the system. Again, to providers in the front lines who've been open through the pandemic, many of them depleted some of their reserves. This is a way to kind of build them back up and get them on a solid foundation. The next piece I want to really excited to focus on, and I'll take a few minutes here to talk about the major initiatives underway. And thank you, Chair Tomko, for touching on those. That last slide's a perfect introduction. The coordinated screening and progress monitoring, it's kind of a mouthful. But just like we have testing in the K-12 system, this is a very, some people are like, oh, testing BPK students, what are we doing? This is a 20 question. It's just a little, takes a few minutes to do, but it's a snapshot. What we want to do is identify students early on who need some extra support, who may be lagging behind on some basic skills like recognizing their letters or their numbers or colors or shapes. So this is a way to see, out of all the VPK students, which ones do we just need to make sure they get extra supports? And so progress monitoring one is in the first 30 days. Progress monitoring two is what we're in the middle of now. And just before I walked over here, I just in my email got the latest update, and there's 82,320 students that have received progress monitoring two. That's out of about 150,000, but just from Friday, that's up like 7,000. So a lot of providers didn't want to try to do that, through the holidays when schedules are off. So now that folks are back in school, that's really going on. And you think, well, how many classrooms are we talking about statewide? It's 12,162. So just imagine, all across the state, some in public schools, most of them privately, and to do something new like this where they have an iPad, it's a touchscreen application, to get that many providers all, and it's 12,000 classrooms across over 6,000 providers, because some providers may have a couple of VPK classrooms, some only one. It's 6,000. Really proud of how everyone has worked together to get that successfully done. The second thing that's a major new thing for, so I guess just the high point is we now have a touch point with every child 3 times a year, beginning, middle, and end, to see and identify those that need extra support. Before, you know, those children might not have been identified or recognized. So that's a huge step. The second piece is the class assessment. Now, this is walking into the classroom, and the assessor will spend like, you know, 3-4 hours there. And what they're doing is observing the adult-child interaction. Because just like food feeds your body, it's the adult-child interaction. That's the that feeds the brain. And so for a child to flourish in those early years, they need lots of brain food, which means they need attentive adults that are not just kind of there making sure everybody's safe, but are truly engaged and interacting. Oh, I like your red shoes, and you know, let's count this, and oh, this is an apple, are you hungry? Like, all that interaction is really important, and that's what this focuses on, 9 dimensions of human interaction. This is research-based, really cutting-edge stuff. Like, that is what has got to be the cornerstone of quality, is that every adult in the room, especially those teachers, are fixated and attentive on every child, and they're interacting with them in a way that's maximizing their growth and development, particularly brain development. So for the first time, I mentioned like that 12,162 classrooms. Imagine the effort to have someone trained to do this, which there's a calibration effort, it's intensive training. It's not just that you go through the training, you have to go through the training and then demonstrate that you can accurately assess a classroom. And then every month you have to calibrate, and we do a lot of things to make sure it's good. But to do 12,000 classrooms when somebody has to schedule it, show up, be there for half a day, huge effort, and that's underway now. And that is going to, again, give us, we've got now touching base with every student, then we're observing every classroom. Now, every lead teacher in all those classrooms now, because of this legislature, has 3 emergent literacy classes that they must take to be that lead teacher. So we have, thanks to this legislature, better trained lead teachers. We're looking at every classroom. And by the way, if the class score is a 1 to a 7, you have to have a 4 just to continue your VPK program. So, which that in itself is just a huge statement about how committed Florida is to a quality learning environment. So I'm going to have to move on. I get excited about this stuff. I have to move on quickly because I want to leave time for the other panelists. Those 2 things are underway. One of the things I did want to touch base on is the implementation of 2524, which is the new funding methodology. That law requires us to, in every provider puts information in a portal that lets us take a snapshot of some information about them that helps us statewide. Under the guidance of 2524, we've added new data elements that we're collecting from every provider. And that's actually, the State Board of Education is meeting today. And in that meeting, they're adopting the rule that puts those in the data elements. So as we speak, the early learning agenda and the rules to implement that legislation are going forward. And I'll certainly be open to ask questions. The final piece I'll take just 30 seconds on is we've moved into the Turlington building. We used to be a separate building, the Office of Early Learning, over at the Lottery building. Now when you walk into the state Turlington building where the Department of Education is, that's where early learning is. All of their divisions, whether it's finance, whether it's IG, whether it's general counsel, those are all HR. Those are now operating under the senior leadership of the Department of Education and Commissioner Diaz. So we have moved over. We're fully integrated. We're part of the K-12 team. We're doing this seamless progress monitoring so we can be sure we identify kids that need support earlier. And we're really excited about what we can do together going forward. So thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll wrap it up there to not take too much time. Thank you,
Mr. Mears. Ms. Shields and Mr. Keister, if you will prepare your remarks.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, and members. Thank you so much for this opportunity. and it truly is, to be able to share the perspective of the childcare business owners as well as operators. The Florida Association for Child Care Management, our members consist of over 1,000 child care businesses in the private sector, and they serve school readiness children, they serve VPK children, they serve private pay children. We really run the gamut through the state to be able to provide that voice for those individuals. So thank you for giving me an opportunity to explain their perspective. Just to give you a brief background on me so that you don't think I'm just some person that you know, rolled up and decided to talk about this. I started my career out of college as a public educator, moved into the private sector, became a VPK teacher, and then a child care school leader. From there, I did work for our lovely Early Learning Coalition in my county, in Brevard County, for 7 years. I ran the provider department, which oversees all of the school readiness contracts and the VPK contracts, as well as the quality initiatives that Chancellor Mears spoke of. From there, I took a position back to the private sector, and I managed the Florida region for the Learning Care Group. I managed all of our compliance in our 80 schools. I kept our babies safe. I did my best. I made sure our schools were meeting or exceeding all of the licensing and contractual obligations. And that's how I landed at FACM, at Florida Association for Child Care Management. I represented Learning Care Group on that board, and then I moved into the executive director role. I love this position. We speak to child care businesses who speak to families every day. So I don't think you're going to get much more of a frontline opinion and perspective than what Roy and I are here to share today. And Roy, as Chair Tomko mentioned, is our vice president as well as our legislative committee chair. We were asked to briefly give some things that we know that are going on right now in childcare that may be issues that the legislature needs to be aware of. And what I know is that families with young children in Florida are still struggling to find quality child care. And it's gotten better, but it has a lot of room to grow. And the bottom line, you know, it's just to put it very bluntly, we don't have enough open classrooms. We're struggling to have our business owners open classrooms because of a workforce issue, which I know childcare is not the only one facing that. But we're a little unique in that perspective because we can't have self-checkout like Target can, right? We have ratios to meet. We need to make sure that those children are safe and healthy and being nurtured and growing, as Chancellor Mears mentioned. So our only option when we don't have a teacher is to shut a classroom down. And as you can imagine, that has quite a domino effect on your constituents, right? I'm sure you've all heard that, you know, childcare is at a premium right now. So we're looking for opportunities to figure out how to open those classrooms, how to bolster our workforce so that we are able to get some qualified teachers that have those amazing interactions that Chancellor Mears spoke of into those classrooms to take care of our youngest citizens. Another issue that we're facing is that, unfortunately, childcare businesses, their owners have to make some really tough decisions. And one of those tough decisions is we're closing infant and toddler rooms because they're very expensive to care for. And that's a problem because we need care for those children. They're just as important as our VPK children that are 4 years old. But when it means that you need to keep your building and your business open, that's a choice that I've seen that has to have been made over the past year or so. And lastly, again, I'm sure you're hearing from your constituents, childcare is expensive right now. So we're looking for opportunities to help parents with that, do our best to run our business in a safe and healthy manner, like I mentioned, but also give those opportunities to parents to have access to quality childcare. The second big thing that I just want to mention, and then I'm going to turn it over to Roy because he's really who you want to speak to. He does this every day. I spoke of the workforce as a current primary challenge. We're really making a concentrated effort as an industry to hire those qualified individuals, recruiting and retaining those qualified individuals. There's been a very concentrated effort on paying a wage for these teachers, that a livable wage, you know, at least the minimum wage, so that they can gain the experience in the child care center and become that class observed teacher that knocks it out of the park. We're really focused on making sure that those individuals are supported, not only financially through a livable wage, but also with the additional resources that we receive from the state and the early learning coalitions. One challenge to that, though, is that we do have, there's quite a bit of red tape when it comes to getting those individuals where they need to be in that classroom. For many different reasons over the past year, we've had roadblocks with background screenings taking 3 to 4 weeks. We've had roadblocks with training, testing. They need to test out early childhood teachers. And the access to that has been very limited. So we are struggling with that because, going back to my Target analogy, you know, if they can make that much money at Target and not wait 3 or 4 weeks to get employment, that's what they're going to do. And that's a shame because we're losing great potential people that can really serve our industry. Lastly, you know, how does this impact the families, your constituents with young children? The burden, unfortunately, sometimes gets passed to them in the form of raising tuition because we need to support those. We need to have the funds to support those individuals in the classrooms. So we're really looking for some solutions to that, as well as how we can maintain that and not have such a burden on the parents. So I am going to turn it over. Again, thank you so much. One last thing, though, before I give up the microphone, I do want to thank our legislators for the increase in the VPK BSA. That was wonderful throughout the industry, throughout the state. We're hearing great things about being able to open up some of those avenues that I spoke of.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Tuck, thank you for the opportunity. It's an absolute privilege to be able to sit here and speak to you guys today on the importance of early learning. A little bit of background on me. So my wife and I own and operate two schools here in Tallahassee. And it's kind of weird how we got into it, because we're kind of entrepreneurs at heart. But I used to run 80 restaurants in the Southeast. My wife was a public relations advertising group director. We traveled a lot. Our parents were raising our kids, and we're like, this isn't what we signed up for. We want to be part of our kids' lives. So we did something crazy. We bought our kids' first preschool. Our parents said, you guys are the smart ones. What are you thinking? When we started looking for childcare, there was not a lot of quality out there. And we looked at ourselves and like, we can do it better. So that's kind of how we got into it. We run our schools. They are a small business, but we run it from a parent's perspective. And I think that's kind of our secret sauce. We don't lose that. It's at our core that we are there to serve the children and the families every day. We see them every single day. No agency can hold us more accountable than our families do. So, you know, and I got to share this because it's something I'm very passionate about. So you see these three little girls. That was their VPK picture at Scottsdale. When they graduated, they went to three different elementary schools, three different middle schools, stayed friends, and then they cheered here at Lincoln High School together. They make lasting relationships. So it's not just about the caring, the loving, the education. It's about creating social, emotional, and creating long-term relationships. We consider our families, our clients, our families. They're our extended family. When you bring your child to Scottsdale, you're bringing them to their second home. You know, I have a background in operations and HR. We kind of brought that in. We have a benefit package for our teachers. We pay our teachers probably higher than the average preschool. They have health insurance, dental insurance, vision. They have a matching 401k with zero vesting schedule. So we try to hire and attract professionals. A couple things I wanted to talk about are challenges or myths. I know this is going to be a big shock. Government does not decide quality. Guess who decides quality? Parents. If parents, we have to wake up every single day to make sure the children and the families we serve are, we are exceeding their expectations. Are they going to take their checkbook and walk to somewhere else that's going to do that for them? So that's at our core. We never want to lose that. You know, Chancellor Mears talked about how important these first 5 years are. 80% of a child's brain is developed by age 3. 90% by age 5. Those connections are happening. You wouldn't build a house on a weak foundation. Why would we build a child's education on a weak foundation? You know, I kind of look at it, if you walked into one of my 3-year-old classrooms today and looked at those kids, you wouldn't know which kid was private pay or which child was school readiness, and you shouldn't. We have an obligation to get every one of those children ready for school. You know, Jennifer kind of touched on a little bit, workforce is our biggest challenge. You know, cost of care is very expensive. When you have one teacher with 4 infants versus one teacher with 10 3-year-olds, you can do the math, the value of that classroom. So that's why there's a lot of centers that are stopping taking infants or 1- and 2-year-olds just because of the cost associated with that. Childcare is a very, very labor-intensive industry. You know, we're unlike any other business where, okay, so we're going to pay our employee, any other business says, okay, we're going to pay $15 or $20 an hour. They do that because they either, A, reduce hours, or they hire 1 or less 2 employees. We can't do that. DCF mandates how many teachers we have with children. We don't have those privileges, and we shouldn't have those privileges. You know, I would say, I think Jennifer touched on it as well, is what our teachers have to go through before they can be in a classroom with a student. And we're not arguing they should have to, but it's a challenge we have to figure out. How do we improve on the process, I guess is the best way to put it. You know, if a teacher has to wait 2 to 3 weeks to get a background screen, and then they have to go through all this training before they can actually come in and work, they're going to go to Target and not wait because they need to make an income as well. So we got to figure out some efficiencies on that. The last thing that I'd like to say to kind of close out is, you know, why do we do what we do? You know, we want to leave this place better than we found it, and children are our future, because let's face reality. The kids in VPK today, some of those are going to be sitting where you guys are. And we have an obligation to prepare them for that. I would say the biggest thing that I get really passionate about, and this is in my office and my wife's office, we received it this year in May, or last year in May. It was a student. It's in a frame. And he graduated from Florida A&M. He started as an infant, and his little card says, "My journey started at Scottsdale Academy. Thank you for contributing to my education, Austin Glenn." That's why we do what we do. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Keister. Next, Ms. Grant and Ms. Marzullo, you are recognized for your opening remarks.
Great. Thank you. Good morning. Thank you, Chair Tomko, Vice Chair Tuck, Ranking Member Williams, and all the committee members here for having us. Thank you for inviting me to participate in this conversation. I am Denise Marzullo. I'm the CEO of the Early Learning Coalition of Duval, go Jags, and I am the chair of the Association for Early Learning Coalitions. We just want to start out by thanking you for the value you're placing in the early education of our youngest learners. The early learning system is a very, very complex system, and I'm going to try to define the role of the coalitions in less than 7 minutes. So I strongly encourage you to reach out, connect with the ELC in your community, their executive director, and tour one of the contracted providers in your area. There is a coalition for every county in Florida, as you saw by the map. There are 30 of us. We were originally created as 501c3 nonprofit organizations under the workforce development because the original intent was so that parents could work and go to school and their children would be in care. However, throughout the years, research has demonstrated, as you've heard, and while you serve on this committee, you're going to hear that 90% number, and it's a really important number. 90% of a child's brain is developed in the first 5 years. And so placing the value on early education is really, really critical. And so because that research was so important, the legislator put us under the Division of Early Learning and the Department of Education, because we are an educational system that is providing a quality education to our youngest learners. So all coalitions are required to follow the same requirements and guidelines, but each one responds to the unique needs of their community. We have a board of directors that includes private sector members, local partner agency executives, three provider representatives, so we have providers that serve on our board, and we have three board members that are appointed by the governor, including our board chair. As mentioned in the chair's presentation, we oversee two very critical early learning programs in the state of Florida. We manage and execute the contracts with the early learning providers. We also conduct all of the eligibility and enrollment for families. So the first program is the School Readiness Program. This is a federally funded program that has state and local match dollars where we serve birth through school agers. We serve a majority of our children ages birth to five, but many coalitions serve a significant number of school agers as well. Parents, in order to be eligible for the School Readiness Program, must be working in school or disabled. They must have a household income at or below 150% of the federal poverty level. And so just to provide some context, in Duval County last year, we enrolled 12,000 children in the School Readiness Program and have 500 contracted providers. As mentioned, providers must meet minimum quality standards and have a class score of a 4.0. And funding per coalition is based on a formula that provides an allocation and rates for reimbursement based on care level, so infant, toddler, threes, and provider type, so whether they're a center or a family child care home. The coalitions are required to meet some very specific fiscal requirements. 78% of all of our funding must go to child care slots. That's really important to understand that we are kind of an in and out. We get the money and we make sure that the money goes for children to get quality care. The other 22% is used for program supports. So that means the developmental health and inclusion. We cannot ignore it. My background, I spent 20 years in mental health. The earlier you identify developmental concerns in children, the very, very likelihood that they can get the treatment that they need. And so we do a lot of developmental health and inclusion supports. We provide professional development for our early educators throughout our contracted providers. Family engagement, we know that if we can connect parents with their early learning providers, that connection will then go into the K-12 system. We oversee all of the quality assessments. As Chancellor Mears mentioned, we have staff that go out and do the class observations in all of our contracted providers. We do childcare resource and referral to make sure that when our parents contact us, they're given resources to meet all of their needs. If they're needing childcare, they're probably needing other assistance as well. And we provide classroom materials to help support our providers so that there are books in the classrooms and developmentally appropriate curriculum for the children. And there is a 5% cap on admin expenses. So we do all of this work and oversee all of these program supports on less than 5%. The second program is the Voluntary Pre-Kindergarten Program, or VPK. This is a state-funded program that was designed to ensure that children who go through the VPK program are ready for kindergarten. Children must be 4 years old by September and live in Florida, and there are no work or school requirements for the family in order to receive this program. Providers are required to use a developmentally appropriate curriculum, and class size is limited to 20 students with two teachers. The school year VPK is 540 instructional hours. And again, providers must meet minimum quality standards and have a class score of a 4.0, which is pretty significant class score for providers. And again, for some context, last year in Duval, we enrolled 8,500 children in the VPK program and had over 300 contracted providers. The fiscal requirements that coalitions are required to manage for the VPK program is that 96% of all funding must go directly to childcare slots. So we still do all of that program supports, the developmental health and inclusion, family engagement, professional development, the class assessments, and we have a 4% cap for all of that program support. All coalitions have a tremendous respect for the fiscal oversight of all of these taxpayer dollars. We welcome the accountability measures that are put in place. We have very strict accountability measures. Oversight for both the VPK and the School Readiness Program is provided by the Department of Education and the Division of Early Learning and their contracted auditors, other state and federal agencies. Plus, the ELCs are subject to single audits every year by external auditors. So our books are open all the time. We learned in the pandemic, as you have heard, that the workforce shortage is significant. We learned that early educators are the workforce behind the workforce. If there aren't enough early educators, people cannot work or go to school. So one of the biggest challenges in the early learning system right now, as mentioned, is the current workforce shortage. So when we ask for additional funding, it's to support providers so we don't continue to lose our quality educators to other industries. Because the lack of quality educators creates empty classrooms and insufficient capacity in many, many of our communities. I just want to close by thanking all of our state legislators. As been mentioned, the recent advancements that have been made to improve our early learning system have been monumental. The ARPA funding has helped to stabilize many of our providers. The VPK base student allocation, as you saw on the chart, significant increase, so important. And we cheered at our conference when that passed. The establishing the minimum quality standards, before the minimum quality standards, as long as you had a license, you were a child care provider, regardless of quality. So these minimum quality standards are really important. The coordinated screening and progress monitoring is going to allow us to track and have the data to show the impact that our VPK programs are having on our youngest learners. And again, the Division of Early Learning being under the Department of Education really shows the importance of that early education for our children. So if I met my goal today, you all are curious about early learning. You want to know more. So again, please connect with your local ELC CEO. Grill them with questions. Grill them with questions about the fiscal oversight. Grill them with questions about accountability. We welcome it. We are proud of the work that we do as the Early Learning Coalitions, and we want to share that with anyone willing to listen to us. So thank you again for your time and your commitment to supporting our youngest learners. You're going to receive a little thank you card in the mail. That's going to be from one of our Jacksonville VPK kids. So look for that to come into your office. And for that, I'm going to turn it over to Molly, who will share some of our legislative thoughts and concerns.
Bless you. And good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. And good morning to all of the members of the committee. As mentioned, my name is Molly Grant, and I currently serve as the Executive Director for the Association of Early Learning Coalitions. I have been with the association for the past 3 years, and prior to that worked at the division, formerly Office of Early Learning, specifically working across the school readiness and VPK program and policy units for implementation of special projects and initiatives. But my favorite role and most important role that I hold is a mother to 7 amazing children, the oldest of which is age 23 and just graduated college recently, down to the youngest, who is 4 and currently participating in the VPK program. So as a parent, obviously, I'm very invested in our state's education system. building on some of what's already been shared by Denise, first, actually building on that, I would like to strongly echo some of the challenges that have previously been mentioned by the former panelists, especially as it relates to workforce. That is very critical. as it relates to families being able to access quality childcare, and then eliminating the red tape for our providers so that they can get qualified staff into those programs. So, and then, of course, supporting parents. So, but then building on what has already been shared by Denise, the ELCs across the state are primarily focused on that one main mission, and that's to prepare our youngest learners for success in their later school and life, ultimately. And through continuously working on improving the effectiveness and efficiency of their early education experiences is how we hope to achieve that mission. The association itself works with all 30 coalitions across the state in support of that mission by providing opportunities for them to participate in peer-to-peer learning, sharing of best practices from their communities, sharing of challenges, problem solving, so that they can learn from one another. We also work with state and local partners to inform changes to policy and systems implementation. And then, of course, educating stakeholders on the importance of Florida's early learning system and advocating for system-wide improvements for children. As it relates to some of the challenges we're currently facing as a system, particularly fiscal challenges, I think overarchingly one of the biggest challenges we continue to face and the most persistent is that there's just not enough funding to go around, right? So based on the number of eligible children that we have throughout our state, we're currently only able to serve a fraction of those eligible. So when it comes to funding, I think our primary goal is to ensure equitable access for all children that we serve, no matter where they are in the state, ensuring that our low-income families can access our programs, preserve their ability to remain in the workforce and or attend education, and then remain on their trajectory towards eventual economic self-sufficiency. And so in order to achieve that, we want to ensure that the funding methodologies and the rates that are set for our school readiness providers account for the services that we're asking our providers to do for us and for those children and families, but that also the allocations, the coalitions take into consideration who are the families that are currently participating in our programs. We don't want our families to lose access, so our current enrollments is truly important. Then looking at the distribution of our eligible populations, we know our families are moving all over the place, you know, especially some of our populations that are transient. Consideration for all of our eligible priority types, including school ready, or I apologize, including our school age and our at-risk populations, critically important. And then addressing unique community needs, such as capacity issues that have been mentioned previously, or areas where there just isn't infrastructure of quality childcare environments. Another challenge that has come up over the past few years, and I don't know that anybody's touched on it quite yet, is that we're starting to see fewer and fewer families even qualifying for school readiness services to begin with. As mentioned by Denise, the current entry level for school readiness is 150% of the federal poverty level. And honestly, Florida doesn't look anything like any other economy in the nation. So alignment of our system to a metric that makes sense for Florida, the state median income primarily, would allow over time the school readiness program to become more dynamic with Florida's economy and what makes sense for our state, and ensure that our school readiness program is always focused on helping Florida's lowest income families on their path to self-sufficiency. And the last thing I want to talk about today is something that was briefly touched on by Denise, also previously mentioned by Chancellor Mears, but another challenge we face is, especially over the last 5 years with the very significant and transformative changes that have happened in the VPK program for accountability and quality requirements, is how providers are supported with onboarding these new requirements, specifically program assessment and the progress monitoring, and just ensuring that in order to be able to help this and support providers in the way that they should be supported, consideration for a separate allocation that is specifically dedicated to quality supports for those providers, ensuring that they have what they need to help children get ready for kindergarten and be ready to learn. So that was a lot, and I probably have a whole lot more if we wanted to get in depth, but I won't take up too much more of your time. But just wanting to reiterate that Florida truly is unique and has a very diverse system, very diverse communities for early care and education. And it has been said, I think, by every person on this panelist that learning and education begins at birth. It doesn't start at VPK. It doesn't start at kindergarten. It begins the moment that child's born with that brain development. And because of the importance of those first years, that first 1,000 days, like Chancellor Muir said, this is where we need to prioritize our investment. And that is truly the path to a successful K-12 system, university system, and ultimately prosperous communities with citizens that are successful. And the last thing I want to say, just because I have 7 children and it is very near and dear to my heart, is that parents are key. Parents are truly key. So it's especially important that we continue to provide our parents with the information, with access to resources, and the support that they need to allow them to be active participants in not just their education, but their growth and development overall. So thank you for your time, and I truly appreciate you inviting me to be a part of this important conversation.
Thank you. Thank you to each of our panelists for your opening remarks. Members, I'm going to turn this over to questions. I would ask that you listen to some of the questions that are asked so we don't have repeated questions. And how we'll do this, if you have a specific panelist that you would like to address, please do that. But if not, and you just have a generic question, whoever you guys can battle it out on who is best to answer the question. We only have about an hour left. So just please try not to repeat anything that has been said so we can make sure we can get as many questions in as possible. And with that, I will open it up to any members that might have a question. Representative Rizzo, you're recognized, and followed by Representative Lopez.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for the presentation. My question goes back to last year, for fiscal year 22-23, the BSA was increased. And I think the number was given, noted it down by $317, specifically to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour for teachers, workers. Has that been achieved?
You're recognized, Chancellor Mears.
Thank you, Representative, and thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, it has largely been achieved. The way we did that was the BSA increase, which was funded with $52 million recurring, that went to everybody. But the additional $100 million was allocated for the wage incentive. And so the way we did, we put it out there and said, if you, as a business owner, will certify that you've established a salary floor for all your staff that work and support the VPK program, then you get the additional allocation. So the reason I can say mostly is because a business could decide just not to. They would get the increased BSA, but not this additional piece. And so we have the last, and I don't have the up to the moment number on that, but it's like over 80%, and this is, they can opt in anytime they want. So it's an ongoing invitation. But when you're thinking about, like, okay, the 2803 BSA is what it is without the $15 wage incentive, for 540 hours, that's $5.19 an hour. So if you're running a VPK program and you don't do the $15 an hour incentive, every hour that goes by for each of your students, you're getting $5.19. If you opt in, you're getting $6.34 an hour. Now, the reason we're all so excited about that is because last year it was $4.60 an hour. So to go from $4.60 up to $5.19 with, you know, 150,000, that's a big difference in the system. But you can imagine with the cost of everything going up, the challenges that you would have when you're looking at, oh, by the way, you have to get background screened, you need these 45 hours of health safety training, which those functions, the licensing is overseen by DCF. So the background screening is something they do, and then the health safety training is something that is through the Department of Children and Families. So I hope that answers your question. We have 80% that have said, yes, we have established the salary floor, and therefore, based on that, they're getting that premium reimbursement.
Chancellor Mears, do you mind following up with us with that information that you mentioned as well?
I will definitely do that, and I'll get you the latest number because I apologize I don't have it. I know it's over 80%. We'll get the exact number.
Okay, wonderful. And Molly, if you don't mind maybe touching on that answer as well, or the question, and if you need him to repeat it, we can have him repeat it.
Yeah, can you repeat the question, Representative Brinson?
Sure. Basically, it was that the last year there was this fund that was created or additional funding that specifically addressed the $15 an hour. And so my question is, do we know that that's been achieved? And I do have a follow-up, Madam Chair, after.
Madam Chair, I think, yes, the intent of the getting the extra $100 million out into communities to support them increasing their wages to $15 an hour has been achieved. But I think the reality is a lot of providers were already at $15 an hour. And so the question is kind of where did they land in terms of utilizing that funding? I think that remains to be seen. But I'm not aware of the total percentage of those dollars that have been utilized by providers. That would be data that Chancellor Mears has. But I think Denise might have some additional insight from the coalition perspective.
I'll just say that it was an easy system for providers to opt into. As they are completing their profile in the system, all they have to do is literally check a box that they will, you know, pay their teacher. So it was very easy to opt in, and the coalitions did a lot of communication to our VPK providers to make them aware of this opportunity for them. For Duval County, I don't have the exact percentages. I'm happy to share it, but I know it was well over 80% opted in.
Thank you. Sorry to put you on the spot, Molly. Recognized for your follow-up.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And perhaps Chancellor Mears or Ms. Marzullo, you may be better equipped to answer this question. What is there any feedback as to this 20% that didn't opt in, perhaps why they didn't?
So I will say that some of our providers don't always keep up with everything that they should on their profile. And as much as we try to communicate with them, they have a lot of responsibilities. They are the director, the teacher, the custodian, the cook, and they often overlook it. And so we do reach out to them, you know, to try to take advantage. Some providers just frankly don't see it and overlook it. So it's hard to say exactly why, but a majority definitely do.
Mr. Keister, if you would like to add to that.
And the additional funding has been very, very grateful. We are very excited about it. But I just also kind of want to put a couple of things in perspective. So we're at 2803, which we're, again, appreciative of. But inception of VPK was in 2005, and we were funded at $2,500 18 years ago. So it's to kind of put those things in perspective. And maybe, Representative, to answer your question, no scientific data on the 20%. I think what Denise says has a lot to do with it. There's a lot of things on the plate. But I think there are some providers. Most of us are already paying that wage to attract and attain those people. But I also think there's a percentage of them that probably aren't there, and those are non-recurring funds. So they're concerned that if they pay their people 15 now, next year, what are they going to do? So that could be part of the reason for some of the 20%.
Thank you. Representative Lopez, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I know the Chancellor in his opening remarks mentioned the funding methodology, the new funding methodology. But since the new funding methodology hasn't been implemented in the school readiness rate reimbursement amount, what is the rate that we're using now? I'm just curious. Thank you.
You're recognized, Chancellor.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. The setting of rates has been removed to the state. The legislature is now the entity that will set the rates. Previously, Denise had mentioned the Early Learning Coalition. Each one has its board. It's a nonprofit. The governor appoints the chair. That was something that would be set locally. So the used to be the board would meet. They would look at data. They would look at how much funding they had, which in the past was essentially a lump sum system. So here's our lump sum. Here's all the needs. There were various requirements. They would set the rate. So that. The rates that were in place as of June 30th, when 2524 became law, whatever those rates were, have just continued forward. And so it was set locally. Those rates are frozen, continued forward, until such time as new rates are set. And so that, just as there was, of course, variability across the different coalitions for those rates, those are now locked in until the the rates are set through the process in 25-24 and the budget process and you know, all of you determining what those rates should be.
Thank you. Vice Chair Tuck, you are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chancellor Mears, just to piggyback off of what Representative Lopez asked, where are we with the implementation of the new funding formula?
You're recognized.
Sure. Well, as I mentioned just very briefly, one of the components of 25-24 was to gather additional data from the field. And so we did two things. One, to get data quickly, we did a survey. It was voluntary, but we asked those questions, and thanks to the help of the Department of Education's IT system, we were able to gather that back and get it. We also revised the rule to add those elements. So the data that will, again, be available to, of course, this body, but also to EDR for rate setting is in place. The process, I think just like long-term, is that each year EDR is going to provide a report to the legislature 90 days before a session, and then that report will just, you know, be a wonderful resource for all of you as policymakers to determine and establish the rates. But until all the principals get together, call EDR, establish that process, right now our focus at the Division of Early Learning has been to gather all relevant data that we have and provide that to EDR for their work and analysis, which is available to all of you to determine what rates that you would like to set and how to establish that through the budget process.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To follow up on what you just mentioned with the data, has all of the data been collected or is it still in process, and what's the timeline for submitting that?
So the survey, all those who chose to respond to it, that has been done. The provider portals and the new data elements, the State Board is adopting that in rule, and the window to update, it's an annual process because we use it for multiple purposes, including the market rate survey, like how much are you charging your private pay customers, because that's an element that's always been considered to determine, like locally, they'd say, okay, how much are private pay families paying? Because when you're a family that's getting the school readiness, you essentially get a ticket that will pay up to a certain amount. Well, if the ticket says you can pay up to $500 a month for care, but when you go to the center, it's $1,000 a month, the family below 150% of poverty, if they want to go there, has to make up that difference out of pocket. So the more valuable that ticket is, the higher the rate is, the more options you have. The federal government has said if you're at the 75th percentile of the market rate, that's considered equitable fair access in the federal guidance. So when you look at the market rate, Florida's not at that 75th percentile, you know, sort of in any county or area. But those are all data points, like the market rate survey, that's done annually. That data is there. There's, under the federal guidance, there's a cost of care estimator that's available. That's been run for sort of mid, low, and high quality. So the only data elements we haven't gathered are the ones that have been added to the profile in today's rule. And when that window closes, which will be the end of the semester this spring, we'll have the final data there that will be sort of driving next year's process. So we had the survey this year to get it quickly, and next year we'll have all the data elements that are in 25-24 available to EDR when those profiles close, which is the window is like the spring. When they close out the year, that's when we take that last snapshot of what the market rate is.
Thank you. Representative Bracey Davis, you are recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I have two, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for this wonderful, insightful presentation. Ms. Marzullo, mission accomplished. You did pique my curiosity. So thank you for that. I have two questions. You mentioned Ms. Shields in terms of opportunities and the challenge of costs. Could you tell us some of the solutions or opportunities that you're able to offer as it relates to the challenge of cost?
Madam Chair?
I'm sorry, you're back.
Thank you. Certainly. So with the help of the funding, obviously, you know, through the ARPA and CERSA funding, the childcare industry has been able to stabilize, as I believe Molly mentioned, and offer, like I said, higher wages. They seem to, you know, that is our number one focus, crucial to get those teachers in. There is a concern for sustainability and being able to do that without increasing cost to parents. So that's a solution that we have come to recognize is, you know, being able to pay someone to be a childcare teacher, which that's a passion. That's not a job you go into because you're going to make a lot of money, obviously. So if we can, you know, just continue to recognize those individuals through compensation, that is definitely a path in the right direction. As far as we mentioned, a major stumbling block is, you know, some red tape as far as getting the teacher into the classroom with the background screenings and the trainings. We've been working closely with the Department of Children and Families to have some solutions presented to childcare in, you know, in this interim while we get those systems back in place and able to, you know, get that path on the right direction. So those are some short term, you know, but we are definitely looking for some long term solutions to that childcare workforce.
And you're recognized for your follow up.
Thank you. How does Head Start correlate with the work that you do? And that's for anyone on the panel.
So I'll answer that. So Head Start is a federally funded program. The major difference between the Head Start program and the school readiness program is there's not the work or school requirement. So parents are not required to be working or in school in order for their child to be eligible for Head Start funding. That's the major difference.
You're welcome. Representative Kennedy, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I come to this issue with a lot of passion and interest in my background. I'm a teacher and also helped start a preschool at a homeless shelter. So I have a lot of empathy from the provider perspective, having done that as a volunteer. So my question is about the professional development piece. And Ms. Marzullo, you mentioned that that was a significant part of your role. And I'm curious from the provider perspective, do you work with the Early Learning Coalition to kind of co-design those professional development pieces? How is that working for you? Do you feel like those pieces are supporting your work and that of your providers?
Mr. Keister, you're recognized.
Yes. So as far as teacher development, that we have career pathways. Some of those we work with the Early Learning Coalitions. There's a Teach Scholarship through the Children's Forum that we work with those on. I think some of the challenges that come from the training and development piece, so teachers have to have a certain amount of required hours in training before they can be in a classroom. They can take those classes online, but they have to show up to a proctored exam. That's where some inefficiencies lie, because there might not be enough slots in that proctored exam. The teacher is not certified to be in the class, even though they've taken the class, until they've completed and passed the proctored exam. We're trying to work on, hopefully in today's age and with what we've learned through COVID, that some of those testings can be online now. That will create some more efficiencies for it. And then the other piece that we're kind of challenged with today on the VPK piece, as Chancellor Mears discussed, you know, there's a lot of great thing that the teachers have to have these emergent lit classes for VPK, which is wonderful. The challenge we're facing today is the way the current law states is if you lose a VPK teacher during the year, your new VPK teacher that you hire cannot start teaching until they've completed those classes. So you're out of compliance. There's no window, like a 90-day window, like they're signed up and they're taking it. You're immediately out of a compliance. And when we're looking for new VPK teachers, you're probably not going to find one that already has that.
Yes, Ms. Shields, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam. We work very closely with each coalition in our membership, and we find that, you know, a lot of coalitions do a really great job with connecting with their programs and their contracted providers to see, you know, what is needed in the community. That's a localized issue that each coalition, you know, addresses. There are a few inconsistencies as far as communication out to the programs when it comes to that, because it is so locally controlled. So we would love to see some more consistency with that, so that we are able to offer the same professional development, you know, across the state, so that all of our professionals can be, you know, recognized in the same manner.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a brief follow-up, and this could be for Mr. Mears or whoever could help me with this. So you mentioned the challenges with the proctored exam. Could you help me understand who administrates that piece?
You're recognized.
It's through Department of Children and Families.
Thank you.
Representative Tuck, you are recognized. I think you had one more question.
Sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. To piggyback off of what Representative Rizzo asked earlier, the FTE numbers that we saw in Chair Tomko's opening remarks show that they exceeded pre-COVID levels in fiscal year 21-22. But for both school readiness and VPK, we still remain below pre-COVID levels for full-time enrollment. Are we seeing an increase in this upcoming year?
Chancellor Mears, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Tuck, Vice Chair Tuck. Yes. So in school readiness, what we do is actually every week we track where we were pre-COVID 19-20 and compare that to our current enrollment. Now, the numbers up here were FTE, which would be, you know, child might be there for one day or might be there for the entire year. Either way, that's an enrollment. But of course, the FTE is if you're there half, two kids half a year, that counts as one FTE. So it's kind of compressing it down to like a full-time load. But the exciting news is we are now 2,606. Our enrollment is that much above pre-COVID in school readiness. So what we've seen, it went kind of low, bounced back a lot last year, and this year we're actually, the enrollment was 182,966 pre-COVID, and now we're at 185,572, so we're up 2,600. In VPK, we do this same thing, and we're up from last year, but we have not bounced back to the pre-COVID level. We're down by roughly 7%, and we really thought that this was the year that the parents would send all their kids back and it would be pre-COVID, but there's still some parents that haven't returned to those levels. So we're down about 7% from pre-COVID. So,
Representative Alvarez, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I feel like I have one question in like 65 parts, thanks to the Chair Marzullo's here asking us to get excited. So this is my excited face right here. So, for me, like trying to grasp these things, if I can even read my own writing here, it's important to understand, and I'm very thankful that you said, hey, like come in, help us take a look, because that level of accountability is super important, especially from the people that are administering it. So that's the vein I'm going down at right now. So knowing that, like, we were looking at VPK metrics, right, on how to go it, and then that the teacher-child observations were key to that. Have you had time to do that? Do you think we're on track to do that? She's already laughing. So so I had 65 questions. So
you're recognized.
Thank you. We are on track. We are very appreciative to DEL and Chancellor Mears' leadership. He provides us data continuously. We have access to all the data for where we are for the class assessments and the progress monitoring. For Duval County, we are at, I want to say, as of Monday, 76% have done progress monitoring too, and most of our VPK providers use the public school calendar, which means they have until February 8th to get that done. So we are well on track to get the progress monitoring 2 done. We had 94% or 96% do progress monitoring 1, so that's fantastic. for the class assessments, we are on track. Coalitions, the interesting thing about the class assessments for VPK is that you have to have a 4.0 or you do not have a contract next year. For school readiness, there was a window in that they were able to be placed on a quality improvement plan for a year so that we can work with those providers in order to improve their class score. For VPK, that's not the case. So some coalitions went into it with the, you know, working again closely with our providers to say, okay, let's go out what our coalition did. Let's go out the gate and do those class assessments right away so that if any VPK programs fall below the 4.0, we have time to work with them, provide that level of professional development so that they can request a second assessment. We can get that done in the spring, and hopefully then they are above that 4.0. Other coalitions worked with their providers, and they requested, no, give us the professional development up front and let us do a lot of professional development in the fall and then do the class assessment so that we are fully aware and oriented to the class. It's a new tool for a majority of our VPK providers. So I would say, yes, the coalitions, and we just had this conversation last week. Coalitions are very confident that we're going to be able to get it done. And that is with a significant workforce shortage, not to take away from providers. They've got to care for the kids. So if I can pick, I'll put the teachers in the classrooms. But coalitions are also, you know, it is a very rigorous assessment that you have to be really trained. You don't want somebody who's not fully trained out there doing this high stakes class assessment. So anytime we lose a class assessor, we've got to then hire a new person, get them trained up, get them, you know, to observe other, you know, tag along with a class assessor. So it's a heavy load, but I'm confident the coalitions are going to get them done.
You're recognized for a follow-up.
Amen. Perfect. So that goes to my next one. So we're on track, or we're getting there, and it's a good effort. What about the consistency? And I'm talking about statewide. So when we go do the observation, what I would like to know is that are we evaluating in Duval the same way we're developing in Hillsborough?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. So in order to conduct the observation, you have to have very specific qualifications and be trained on the observation tool itself before and determined reliable before you're able to go out there and do observations. As a standard practice, a lot of coalitions will also engage in a practice what they call double coding, where they'll send out two assessors to kind of gut check, right, the observations to ensure a greater chance of validity on the result of that observation. So yes.
Follow-up?
Oh, yes, ma'am. Thank you for that. So, all right, so the monitoring program, when you brought it on board, how was the implementation? Like, and let me give you the perspective. We have these great ideas, and we think that from these desks here to the street or the classroom, we have a vision. But what we want to know is, we had it, we put it in, how did it actually get implemented?
You're recognized.
So we had the same concerns. How are we going to do this for all the VPK classrooms? We were given an allocation to provide the technology supports to those classrooms. So we did a mass distribution of iPads and tablets to get to. We worked with DEL to procure those and to get them out into the classrooms. We worked with our teachers to make sure they understood how to. It wasn't without its bumps, but I will say it was. I did not receive any personal complaints, and believe me, the providers will call me on my cell. But I didn't really receive to. There were some technology issues at first. Chancellor Mears put us in touch directly with, you know, the experts to answer those questions, so we didn't have to kind of go through somebody to get to an answer. We were able to directly get those answers and technology supports. So I would say it was. Well-intended and well-executed. Absolutely.
You have a follow-up?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. All right, so that is exactly what we want to hear. From the ground that the state, you know, agency that's in charge is supporting, and there's a lot of back and forth. So my hat's off to you, sir. I appreciate that effort, and thank you for that honest assessment. Minor shift. So the quality dollars for the school readiness program, right? Do you think the coalitions are utilizing them in an effective manner? How is that part of your program going? Give me just like a same thing. Give me your gut feel on how that's going.
You're recognized.
Great. So it's going well. We do our very best to work with providers. In response to the question about professional development, we, you know, send out surveys to all of our providers, ask what are their training needs. The quality dollars that we use are to implement all of the supports to the providers. We operate and manage, I mean, our budget alone in Duval County was $96 million last year, and our admin was $2.2 million. So in order to effectively serve over 20,000 children, we did that on a very small admin percentage, but I do think we do it well because we're able to spend 22% on those quality supports. So doing the materials to make sure providers have that, to do the professional development, the developmental health and inclusion, the ages and stages questionnaires, which identify any developmental issues with children, is so critical for our school readiness children. So in order to effectively get all of those supports out, I think we do it in an excellent way. And we are audited consistently by DEL as far as, I mean, they will pull a $5 receipt and say, how does that directly correlate with quality initiatives? And we have to have the documentation to support it. And so we are regularly held accountable for every dollar spent in quality.
We're going to give you one more out of your total of 65.
Make it your best one.
I'll take 16 out of 65, Chair. Thank you so much. All right, so you got me there. I didn't have this one until you just said that. So how do you measure those outcomes, like when you're spending those dollars? And so it's a two-parter. That's Duval.
Way to get statewide.
I bifurcated that question. Thank you, ma'am. How do you get statewide? Like, so Duval's doing great. What about statewide, the consistency in that as well?
You're recognized for the 1 to 2 questions that Representative Alvarez asked.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in terms of statewide, similar to what Denise said, every quality dollar that is spent has to be monitored and is tied to either a federal requirement of our grant program or to one of the state requirements that is in statute. So I think statewide, of course, you know, our coalitions are all various sizes. There are very unique community needs. They are one of the requirements they have is that they're tasked with doing a community needs assessment, and they regularly try to gauge the needs of what the providers are needing in those individual communities, what the community itself needs in terms of quality initiatives. But I will say, because of the fact that they are various different sizes, there are different resources available to different communities as well. Some of our larger coalitions may be able to leverage local funding, right, to increase the amount of quality support they're able to provide to their community and to providers, whereas some others may not have that opportunity in their communities. So it's different across the state. But again, in terms of looking at tying what they are doing in quality, it is very, very tightly tied to specifically what is required both federally and or by the state.
Thank you. Representative Gonzalez-Pittman, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the fabulous presentation. You hit on it. I'm an educational researcher, so I love that you all are doing intra-reliability. I would like to be provided, if you would, a copy of the rubric that you use to evaluate the classroom. And then I also have another question.
You're recognized.
Thank you. What does it cost to train and do a background check?
You're recognized for whoever would like to answer that.
So thank you, Madam Chair. I'll go ahead and jump in. I think that's two pieces, okay? So for the training piece, for the introductory childcare requirements for DCF, that's to be a licensed provider, it's 45 hours. I think it's a combination of about 5 different courses total, 5 to 6 different courses total that are offered by the Department of Children and Families in various areas. And the cost of those courses when taken online, I believe, ranges anywhere from $15 to $20 a course. And then on top of that is the cost for the proctored exam that Roy mentioned before, which I believe is $5 for every hour of the course. I think that's correct.
I would need to follow up with the very specifics from the Department of Children and Families on what that actual cost is. In terms of how long they have to complete that, they're required by DCF to begin those trainings within the first 30 days of employment, and then they have a year to a year. I apologize. I'm going to defer to Roy real quick on the timeline to complete those trainings. However, for the school readiness program, there are certain courses that have to be completed prior to being left alone in the classroom with a child. And that's what they refer to as the pre-service health and safety training. And there are two options to complete that. One is a subset of those DCF courses, 24 hours, that covers health and safety standards. Or there are some online courses that were developed through the University of Florida Lastinger Center, which is a total of 12 hours, specifically targeting the health and safety topics that are required by the federal regulations for pre-service training. And those are free and available online to any provider that wishes to utilize them to get the teacher in the classroom. I think some of the concerns maybe, and I will defer to Roy on this, is that it creates a little bit of duplication in the requirements for that provider. And then in terms of background screening, I think that varies throughout the state as well. It depends on the cost of the life scan screening. But my understanding is that it is anywhere from $75 sometimes to $150 for the total life scan screening.
Right.
Mr. Barry Keister, you're right.
As far as the background screening, it does vary upon the state, and sometimes providers will negotiate with local life scan people to come up with a price, but it ranges, like Molly said, the low end, the lowest I've seen is like $65 up to like $120. But then you also have, because of the block grant, we have to do out-of-state screenings on those states, and those out-of-state screenings, I'm going to say on average, they're not terrible, $15 to $25. The challenge with the out-of-state screenings, if you take school readiness, is you're dependent on when that state gets you that back. So if you don't get it back in a certain time period, you can get a provisional, but I believe it's after 45 days, that provisional goes away if we don't get it from the other state. As far as background screenings. As far as the training, if you are not a school readiness provider, you have to start that initial 45 hours of training within your first 90 days, and then you have a year from that time frame to complete it. The exceptions are there's a health and safety for birth that you have to finish within the first 30 days, and then if you do take school readiness, you have the 24-hour pre-service requirement. Where Molly was talking about the duplicativeness of that is every provider is a little different. We would try to push our providers, our teachers, not to do that, because if they do that, they have to do those hours, and then they have to do on top of that the additional 45 hours of DCF. If they just do the first, I think it's 12 within DCF, that will suffice. Again, the challenge is you can take the class online, but you might not be able to get into the proctored exam.
Follow up?
Yes.
You're recognized.
Parent involvement is key to a child's success. How are you implementing child or parental involvement classes?
You're just recognized.
Sure. So our family engagement team works with providers. Each community is different. In Duval, we have a mentorship program where we have some providers that are phenomenal at family engagement and some new providers who are newer to family engagement. And so we pair them up and they work together to share best practices. And then we share those in our provider e-blast to all the other providers. And so they'll do family nights, they'll do different, activities with parents. The program is based on parental choice. All school readiness and VPK is parental choice. And so providers have an incentive, to have family involvement. And so we do a lot of work to provide and share best practices across the state with providers. We also, through COVID, found one of the significant impacts that COVID had that you may not think about is the family engagement. So families were required to kind of pull up, let Johnny out of the car, and then pull up in the afternoon and get Johnny back in the car. And there was no interaction with the teacher. Hardly I even met the teacher. So we were able to provide some technology supports. There are apps out there. Of course, there's an app for everything where they can share pictures, share, you know, of their child throughout the day. The teacher can provide instant feedback to the family. Johnny had a great day, you know, needs to work on this. Here's some, you know, coloring sheets for them. So technology was really important for family engagement. And so each coalition is able to identify the unique needs in their community and then share best practices amongst all of us for what's working with family engagement.
Thank you.
Sure. Ranking Member Williams, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. When you spoke about the 45 hours that's required for someone to actually go into the field of early learning or child care, because the 45 hours cannot be taken prior to starting a career in this path, how are you working around that?
You're recognized.
You can start. There's certain things you can start. The only thing that right now you can't is the VPK Emergent Lit. They have to have that before they can start teaching VPK. But the pre-service hours or the 45 hours, as long as they start it within 90 days of employment, then they have a year from that time frame. They can do those while they're working in a classroom.
You're recognized for a follow-up.
So are you encouraging them to actually start the pre-service classes prior to, or are we connected with some type of community partnership with different organizations?
You're recognized.
We push them, like, so our system, even though they have 90 days to start and a year to finish, we kind of have our own policy within our schools that we want those completed within 6 months, unless it's pre-service hours. And what we do is we'll have our director create a career pathway and actually not wait for the teacher to sign themselves up. We'll sign them up, say, here you're signed up for the class. Here's when you're signed up for the proctored exam to do that. We're kind of driving that process within our school internally.
Representative Dunkley, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, everyone, for the great presentation and the learning that I was able to garner this morning from all the presentations. I wanted to address, and I think it's Ms. Shields, you said that there was not enough open classroom because of our workforce issues. And we've been talking about background screening being part of that, you know, the time frame that it takes to get back. I'm not sure if we could, if you could tell me, have we looked into what part or if there a standard process that causes that background screening piece to be taking that long so we're not having, you know, the results coming back in that timely manner? Have we looked at that as a portion that we can speed it up if we can?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam. Yes, we are actually working very closely. A big part of what we do in our association, we have an all-volunteer board and members. You know, they're all childcare business owners. So we look for resolution directly so that we can move these things fast. We've worked very closely in the past few months with the Department of Children and Families, because that's who the background screenings go through, as mentioned, to try to figure this out together, to be solution-based. And Director Way Reynolds has been amazing in that partnership, and we are working through that. Just like everyone else, there are staffing issues, which, you know, we're at the heart of that. So we're working through that, and we're really looking to partner to figure those things out. We've also been in contact with other states. You know, there's other me's in the world in other states to see what the resolution has been in other states for the background screening issues.
All right. Representative Michaels, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you all for your presentation. My district is made up of military bases, and I'm listening to everything, and I appreciate your presentation. But often what I'm hearing from my district is from the military families is that their children miss the opportunity for the pre-K education. And that's made up of several different things. It's just a lot of movement of the families. But getting the information available, like, for instance, we have military Mayport Elementary School. But they would love to have a VPK program there. How do we get information to them? And then what is the – how does this affect I don't know how many military bases or children or families you work into the equations and numbers that you have here, but really is – what is the impact financially to – for the appropriations, for monies, the funding, and everything that you need to incorporate our military kids?
Whoever wants to tackle that is recognized. You're recognized.
So either through it's an accrediting body or like schools, we will apply. So, you know, we have National Guard here in Tallahassee. So we have military families that are using that. We've applied for that military piece. So then their children that come to our school get paid through that program and is, I don't want to call it subsidized, but they pay part of that child's tuition because of the military. But it's an application process you have to go through.
Representative,
Thank you. Just to add a little bit to that as well, for our areas that are heavily saturated with military bases, I know the coalitions do work closely with some of the child development programs that are located on those bases. To increase opportunities, not just on the base, but then off-site as well for when they need childcare capacity. So I know I've been involved in many of those conversations, in especially the Panhandle area. So
I'll just add, too, that if an elementary school wants to have a VPK program, the public schools can start one. They just get a contract with us. For Mayport Elementary, for example, could definitely get a contract with the school district to have a VPK classroom, and we have several in Duval County that have VPK classrooms, and they fill up very quickly. The public school VPK classrooms fill up very quickly because most times if there's a four-year-old, there's a six-year-old or an eight-year-old also, and so it's convenient for families. So we work very closely with the school districts to have VPK classrooms.
You have follow-up? You're recognized.
If I could just talk with you one-on-one afterwards, that'd be great. Thank you.
Wonderful. Well, members, I appreciate our thoughtful discussion that we had today and really appreciate our panelists. Chancellor Mears, did you have something to add?
If I may, Madam Chair,
absolutely.
Question I got before, the crack staff at DEL got me the December number on how many have opted in to the $15. We are up to as of when it closed out December, and that's the latest date we have at our fingertips, 5,246 VPK providers have opted in to the $15 wage incentive. So that's, they've established that salary floor, which is 84%. So it's continuing to go up. And I think Mr. Keister, I think there are some that's because it's one-time funding, they may be thinking, well, once we give everybody a raise, what if this funding isn't continued? Can they sustain it? So that may be the hesitation. So I just wanted to, so you'd all have the benefit of the latest data, and thank you for your question and the professional development piece. The Lastinger Center, this is what I forgot in my update, has done an emergent literacy micro-credential. I think it's probably the first in the country. It's competency-based. It's 60 hours. And the legislature appropriated $30 million for incentives. And so that was available January 1. And what they've put the credential together, and there's a $2,000 incentive for VPK and school readiness teachers to get that training. And this is a stackable credential that counts towards your CDA the way it's been structured, which your CDA is a credential that where you can be a lead teacher in VPK, and it also accounts for college credit. So it really is a way, it's an exciting new development. And I just, with the questions on PD, wanted to highlight this legislature's initiative to establish the micro-credential, have it be competency-based, And the New Worlds Reading Initiative has taken that work on and is doing that. And it is launched, and we have almost 1,000 early learning teachers that have already signed up. So it's very exciting.
Great. Thank you for that update. We really appreciate it. And thank you all for being here today. And I'm sure this does not stop many of the discussions that will happen. And I'm sure some of our members will continue to reach out to you for questions. Just wanted to let everyone know our next meeting is scheduled for Tuesday, January 24th from 3:30 to 5:30 with a presentation from the department on the federal COVID relief funds. This concludes our committee agenda. Members, I would ask if you would stay for an additional moment. We have public testimony. Mr. Keith Flaw with Florida Citizens Alliance, you are recognized. If you could be brief in your comments, Mr. Flaw, we'd appreciate it. Do you mind making sure the microphone is on? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and committee. I represent Florida Citizens Alliance. We focus exclusively on K through 12. But many of you may remember when the Department of Education released its FSA test last spring, 75% of our third graders cannot read and do math, or cannot read at grade level out of proficiency 4 and 5. So if you back that up to pre-K, my question is, are we being aggressive enough, setting the bar high enough in pre-K to get phonics into those? I recall the comment, 90% of the brain is developed in those first 5 years. Are we setting the bar high enough in pre-K on a phonics program to improve the yield as they get into our public schools? My second comment has to do with social-emotional learning. Very anecdotal. I'm working with one of our pre-K schools in Collier County, and they tell me they're a Christian academy, and they're telling me that social-emotional learning is coming in full force in pre-K, and coming from the department. And so I just think it's important that we all understand that social-emotional learning is now part of critical race theory, and we have to be guard against that. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I appreciate you coming and speaking with us. So this concludes our committee agenda. Seeing no further business, Representative Lopez moves we rise. And without objection, the meeting is adjourned.